Good evening and welcome back on this Saturday, the 27th day of June. I'm your host, Mark Call, and I wish I had better news tonight. But the truth is that the United States, and indeed the whole world, seems to be intent on committing suicide by stupidity, which, as Robert Heinlein once pointed out, is truly the only universal capital crime. The examples over just the last week are literally mind-numbing. But given limited time tonight, we'll just have to pick a few to set the stage. All of which brings me to the observation that I was compelled to start off with today, and let's call it, when Orwell is no longer news. Have you noticed how much of a rash we've had lately of not just riots, looting, mayhem, murder, and all kinds of other carnage, all with the same obvious goal of putting a final wooden stake into the heart of what's left of the Constitutional Republic, but the Orwellian attempt to rewrite history is literally going on now at warp speed. It was obviously never going to be enough to destroy statues of real men of honor, like Robert E. Lee, just because they, too, once fought for their country, which was a republic, and in the case of Robert E. Lee, we're talking about Virginia. No, the nihilist Antifa left has moved on to other targets, like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Anybody, in other words, who had anything to do with the form of government they are utterly intending on destroying. And this week we've seen attempts to destroy the statues and even remembrance of presidents like Teddy Roosevelt and Andrew Jackson. And there's no shortage of irony, too. A lot of these Antifa idiots that don't even begin to understand how much they are behaving just like the fascists they claim to hate but really emulate are now even tearing down statues that they might have liked if they had any understanding of what they're trying to tear down. But here's what really bugs me, folks. Yes, it certainly includes the fact that there's been no outcry against the obvious evil running rampant in the United States today, but we've already gotten inured to that. It's the fact that there are so many people who are so utterly ignorant of history that they want to destroy it so that nobody else will know anything about it either. And among other things, that pretty well makes the 100% total failure rate of communism everywhere it's been tried, and all the other socialist agendas too that they want to implement, harder to argue against. After all, if you can forget history or even rewrite it, they seem to think you can repeat it with impunity. So here, folks, is the theme we need to start off with this evening. The warnings that George Orwell laid out in books like Animal Farm and, most importantly, 1984, are now so commonplace in America with a K, they're no longer even news. Not, of course, that most of the people who are doing the destruction have ever bothered to read anything like his books anyway. But note that that doesn't mean all of them. I have no doubt that George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Hussein Obama, or whatever name he's using today, have read these things, but intend them to be interpreted as an instruction manual instead of a warning. And in a related vein, the other big theme of the week seems to be political correctness run amok, not just in America, but in most of the world. But as we've watched this latest communist insurrection unfold, it's clear things have gone way beyond political correctness to outright insanity. First, from the far left coast and the state of Oregon, where Lincoln County has done the usual idiotic thing and created a mandatory mask rule. Achtung, yes, even though these things don't make a darn bit of difference, you must have one if you intend to go out and pretend you're a free person. But just wait, this goes far beyond the ordinarily asinine. Lincoln County's public health directive, Achtung, mandates that all individuals in Lincoln shall wear face coverings in all public settings, including outdoor areas, if proper socialist distancing is not maintainable. However, in addition to certain disabilities, the new order exempts, ready for this, people of color who have heightened concern about racial profiling and harassment. So unless you're white, the idiotic rules don't apply to you. And says none other than RT's coverage, the order has prompted an outpouring of criticism and even confusion, with some folks baffled that such a blatantly racist policy could pass muster in 2020. Nah, they just don't understand hypocrisy becoming insanity. Oh, and one more thing, folks. Can yellow stars for those people be far behind? Kind of makes you wonder if the Nazis made people bow down to them and shine their shoes. But just to show you that the insanity isn't only a far-left coast thing, we have this story out of the UK from Paul Joseph Watson about a man who wasn't drinking the Kool-Aid. And to prove it, he flew a White Lives Matter banner over a soccer match, they say football over there, in the UK. Such an act of political not correctness provoked widespread condemnation and, of course, a police investigation. Ok-tung, even though authorities had to conclude subsequently that there was no actual criminal offense that had been committed. Well, yet, anyway. The man actually responsible for the banner, a football fan named Jamie Heppel, faced the social media witch hunt, to which he ultimately responded with a two Facebook post that read, quote, "I'd like to take this time to apologize," and the following is all in caps, folks, "to absolutely f***ing nobody," exclamation point, unquote. However, after a Twitter mob discovered the employment details of his girlfriend, Megan, she was fired by her employer simply for being guilty by association. And a statement released by the company said they were willing to help Megan even by paying for her, quote, "intensive racial sensitivity training." But since she refused re-education, she was fired for being the boyfriend of a man who actually believes that white lives matter. In the United States, socialist New York City is no less insane. The New York City Department of, they say education, I'm going to say indoctrination, has launched an investigation into what the Daily Mail calls a troubling Facebook post penned by an employee of a Staten Island high school, Deborah Morse Cunningham, who serves as the assistant principal of New Dorp High School, is still at work, though, mused the British leftist, despite sharing a two Facebook post in which she displayed a surprising amount of candor and even sanity. No, folks, they certainly didn't say that, but I did. "What is privilege?" asked Morse Cunningham in the post, which, of course, has now been deleted. "Privilege," she continued, "is wearing $200 sneakers when you've never had a job. Privilege is wearing $300 Beats headphones while living on public assistance. Privilege is living in public subsidized housing where you don't have a water bill, where rising property taxes and rents and energy costs have absolutely no effect on the amount of food you can put on your table. Privilege is the ability to go march against and protest against anything that triggers you without worrying about calling out of work and the consequences that accompany such behavior." And here, folks, I have to insert something. The opposite of privilege is having to worry about telling the truth and being fired for your candor. Or, I guess, given the news today, having your loved ones fired for your candor. Arguably even, and oh, don't you dare say this, because of your skin color. The lengthy post continued, "Privilege is having as many children as you want, regardless of your employment status, and being able to send them off to daycare or school you don't pay for." Communist mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, said he hadn't read the post, but was still, quote, "very concerned," because no one should be allowed to use what he called racially insensitive language. Especially someone who's an educator. Oops, well, I guess he used the wrong term there. An indoctrinator. Because educators are not only supposed to tell kids the truth, they're supposed to actually teach them how to think, which is why we don't have that anymore. Now, as for your host, I'm actually surprised they haven't done a lot worse things to this woman. But I gotta admit, I'm also surprised and thankful that there are still a few good people in places like the New York City educational system that haven't yet been forced out. And moreover, still have the courage to speak up against a system they know is going to try to destroy them. There is, of course, another side to that coin, and it kind of demonstrates what happens when bigotry becomes politically correct. At Cambridge University this week, we saw one of the worst in-your-face examples of real racism, hatred, and bigotry writ large, when one of its so-called academics tweeted, quote, "I'll say it again, white lives don't matter as white lives." Now, do I even need to point out here what would have happened to anybody, especially a person not of color, who dared to say anything even remotely that disgusting about any racial group that it isn't just perfectly fine to hate and destroy? Dr. Priyamvada Gopal, English academic, Sikh, and Churchill Fellow at Cambridge, originally started off her racist, hate-filled screed by tweeting, "Abolish whiteness." Only later did she follow that up by adding, "I'll say it again, white lives don't matter." There is a bit of good news in here because that prompted the launch of a petition to have this particularly disgusting woman fired, which, when Paul Joseph Watson's story came out at Summit News, had about 15,000 signatures. And the tweets were evidently so far over the top, even for the far left, that Twitter had to act a bit out of character and remove them as what they actually are, hate speech. But, sadly, there's more to the story, because as Watson tells us, both the university and what your host can't help but think are some racist media outlets responded by trying to frame a narrative that Gopal was being abused, no, not because she's a bigot, but by a hate-filled mob. And as a result, all of the smug, politically correct gatekeepers decided to pardon her for her incredibly, overtly racist comments. But that's not all. Cambridge went on to reward her as well. But here's how the new professor of English hypocrisy put it. Quote, "Thanks to everyone who wrote to Twitter, that ludicrous ban has been lifted. I am therefore delighted to share with you personally that last night Cambridge promoted me to a full professorship," tweeted the disgusting Gopal. "The hate mails and threats are coming in nonstop, but at Cambridge, cops are following up." Unquote. So see, folks, some racists really are more equal than others. Now, by the way, folks, now that that's all said and done, let me point out something else that I think is important here. It seems to me, although I don't know her personally and I don't have any desire to, that Dr. Priyam Vada Gopal is a racist pig whose opinion, realistically, shouldn't be of any real interest to anybody with half a brain. But even so, if she was in America, and I'm kind of thankful she's not, we got plenty of evil here already. And if we believed in free speech, and obviously most Americans no longer do, even so, so-called hate speech is not a real crime, and if we still had a First Amendment, it would in fact, like it or not, be protected speech as well. Now, what bugs me, and I hope will bug everybody that's listening to this, is the hypocrisy here. Because by definition, hate speech is something spoken by somebody that the writers of the so-called law, and of course their Ministry of Truth gatekeepers, hate themselves. And now we've clearly reached the place, again, where some racist, hate-filled bigotry is somehow perfectly okay. And so no wonder these people hate and want to destroy history as well, because they're repeating it. And all I can think to add is, this woman would have been a great candidate for one of Hitler's top positions. Oh, wait a minute. Cambridge already has her. Oh, and before we move on, if we can stand it, I've got one more bit of politically correct idiocy to the max to report today. Walmart, that paragon of communist Chinese virtue, has banned the Mississippi state flag, calling it another Confederate symbol. And they, along with the College Athletics Conference that calls itself the SEC, are now pressuring the state of Mississippi to change their historic state flag, the only one among the 50 states that actually still incorporates features from the Confederate battle flag. And according to Reuters, the country's largest brick-and-mortar retailer, while it lasts, says it will not display the Mississippi state flag in its stores and will remove all items from its website that dare to bear the symbol. And are you ready for this? This decision follows a wave of public indignation, or so we're being told, over the sale of merchandise branded All Lives Matter. How dare anybody suggest heresy like that? Obviously, certain lives don't matter, whether they're in the womb or bearing the wrong color nowadays. And Mississippi state lawmakers, says the piece here from Zero Hedge, are weighing whether or not to remove the Confederate battle flag features from the state flag, now that the NCAA and SEC are threatening what really matters in the state, Ole Miss and their ability to bring home NCAA championships. Maybe they won't have to worry about any of this, folks, if Big Brother manages to shut down all sporting events. But I can't help but think that maybe it's time for the Mississippi State Legislature, rather than continuing to cave to politically correct idiocy run amok, to reconsider secession, especially if the former free United States seems insistent on turning into a literal hell on earth.
So this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause.
After all of that, we do need a bit of good news, so let's go here. Because even in socialist France, it would seem, a glimmer of hope flickers. From Quoth the Raven's blog via Zero Hedge, 500,000 users in socialist France have decided to uninstall the French contact tracing app. And yes, it begins New York City, Norway, and Germany, and I'm sure other socialist enclaves soon, have each struggled to get their contact tracing programs off the ground. In NYC, an army of 3,000 brown shirts, contact tracers, have struggled to glean information from a reluctant patient population. But here's where it gets really ugly, at least so far as Big Brother is concerned. French public health officials are running into similar problems as the much-heralded new phone app for tracking coronavirus cases has only alerted 14 people that they were at risk of infection since its ceremonious launch 3 weeks ago, according to France's digital affairs minister, while almost 500,000 users have righteously decided to uninstall the disgusting app. Now, a brief pause here. We, of course, already know what Big Brother's response will be. If people don't want it, we'll just hide it and make darn sure that they can't turn it off. In other words, just exactly what Gulag and Apple have been doing for so long anyway. Here's a bit more good news. Turns out that there might even be a federal appeals court that still cares about the rule of law. Because in a 2-1 decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit Court, the court has ordered the dismissal of the criminal case and railroad job against former National Security Advisor and retired Army General Michael Flynn. They've overturned U.S. District Court Judge Sick Emmett Sullivan's decision to appoint a retired judge to file a friend of the court review of the case, and as the Wall Street Journal reported, ordered Sullivan to dismiss the case altogether. Hear, hear. All of this after new evidence, which the deep state minions have tried to keep hidden for so long, was revealed in April. The DOJ concluded in late May that Flynn's January 24, 2017 interview was, quote, conducted without any legitimate investigative basis and was untethered to and unjustified by the FBI's counterintelligence investigation into Mr. Flynn, unquote. But hey, here's a surprise. We learned later on in the week that there may have been a reason after all. Because it turns out, according to Flynn's attorney, Sidney Powell, who appeared on Fox Business Channel Thursday morning, her client was planning to audit U.S. intelligence agencies before the fateful 2017 interview that was used by the FBI to railroad him, and to use an old expression you may have heard, CY their A's. As Sidney Powell puts it, the FBI and other three-letter agencies were absolutely terrified of the idea of an honest person getting the job of National Security Advisor and unearthing things they wanted to stay buried. From there, we'll go next to some bad news. It's only good news if you realize it's finally being revealed, starting with this piece from Zero Hedge about the American Hospital Association, a.k.a. AHA, which warns in a new report that, quote, hospitals and healthcare systems faced catastrophic financial challenges in light of the COVID-1984 pandemic. Now, they did spell it wrong there, but you get the idea. From soaring COVID-19 costs to canceled services to plunging hospital revenues to purchasing personal protective equipment to reimbursement of landscape challenges to decreasing patient volumes, it's about a quadruple whammy against hospitals. Many of these factors have triggered a recent bankruptcy wave, says the piece, and or closures of hospitals literally all across the country. Evidently, just reclassifying all deaths as coronavirus deaths and reaping $20,000 or $30,000 a pop for the fallacy didn't quite cover the costs. Said AHA, the virus pandemic has created a cash crunch for many hospitals, and these medical facilities are expected to lose upwards of $200 billion between March 1st and June 30th, or about an average of $50.7 billion per month. And there's more. U.S. non-federal hospitals are expected to lose about $161.5 billion or so in revenue over the next 4 months due to canceled services, including non-elective surgeries and outpatient treatments. So, concludes Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden, it's not just shopping malls, restaurants, and hotels that are going bankrupt, along with most of middle America. It now appears an alarming number of hospitals, too, are closing and or filing for bankruptcy as well. So just imagine the financial ruin that the pandemic phase two, they say could, I will suggest will, unleash on America's hospital system, in addition to the rest of what's still standing. From there we go to this interesting piece, also from Zero Hedge, entitled The Latest State-Level Coronavirus Tracking Information Shows an Alarming Trend Reversal. Now, if your eyebrows, like mine did, go up and you hear that headline, just listen to how they begin this piece. Whether one believes or not the official virus data, or is willing to dismiss it as part of a plandemic, all of that is irrelevant, they say, for two reasons. One, markets still respond to every incremental headline, fully aware that it will shape fiscal and monetary policy, especially when it comes to various Fed speakers warning, as of yesterday, that a second wave, booga booga booga, would lead to even more Fed intervention. Think money printing to infinity, folks, and that means hyperinflation somewhere down the road. and two, that the global coronavirus pandemic stopped being about epidemiology a long time ago and has since become, and this I have no disagreement with at all, a political weapon to be used at will by those with the obvious socialist agenda. It's also, they note, why various states will be eager to use whatever data is published to pursue their own political intentions, which according to many involve a new round of shutdowns sometime during the late summer and in any case ahead of the elections to encourage another economic meltdown, probably the final one your host will suggest, and further crippling Trump's re-election chances, despite the administration's solemn vows that a second wave shutdown is not on the horizon. So, what does the data show? And do you trust it? According to the latest Goldman state-level coronavirus tracker, the prevalence of coronavirus symptoms is rising, booga, 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 with the share of patients seeking care with symptoms of COVID-like illness now at 3.5%, up almost 0.4% from 2 weeks ago. Daily confirmed new cases have risen steadily over the past several days to 86 per million people. Not exactly what you call a dramatic number, folks. Ending a two-month decline, though. And a big part of this, obviously, is a result of increased testing. Indeed, the volume of daily coronavirus testing has risen 23% over just the last 2 weeks, while the positive test rate has increased a bit as well. But here's the key, folks. What is the false positive number? Well, you're not going to hear that. On the flip side, though, fatalities have declined over the last 2 weeks, and that includes even counting everybody who dies with an alcohol-related fatality or hangnail, a COVID patient. That number is down 12% to 1.9 per million people, although, of course, fatalities do lag new cases for obvious reasons. Oh, and by the way, that booga 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 fatality rate is well below the following major causes of death in the United States per million folks, such as, in increasing order, diabetes, Alzheimer's, stroke, chronic lower respiratory diseases, unintentional injuries, cancer, and of course, heart disease. And wearing a mask won't prevent any of those either. But taking care of yourself goes a long way towards reducing the risk of all of them, and that includes the booga 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 virus. There is reason for Americans who still value their livelihood or liberty to be paying close attention to Big Brother's moves in the next few weeks, because, as Zero Hedge reminds us, the federal government recommends that states, being subservient to Big Brother, of course, meet four criteria if they intend to proceed with reopening. In other words, if they hope to actually begin to return to something approaching the rule of law. Number one, symptoms should be declining. How are you going to tell if people are wearing masks? Number two, new cases should be declining. And think about the importance of having both more testing and more false positives on that score. Number three, the positive test rate should be below 10%. And number four, at least 30% of ICU capacity should be available. Now, that one's particularly interesting because, as the Goldman report notes, states could make their own decisions, but a decline in hospital capacity below 20% could pressure states to consider slowing or even reversing their so-called reopening. And if a whole lot of hospitals go bankrupt, folks, that may be a pretty big hurdle, especially if ICU capacity declines dramatically because hospitals just plain close their doors. And this, too, is interesting, if not even alarming. Currently, two states, Arizona and South Carolina, which account for 4% of the total U.S. population, meet none of the four Big Brother-imposed criteria. Eight states, including Texas and Florida, meet only one of them. We'll come back to Texas in a minute. 14 meet two of them. 12 meet three. And only 14 states meet all four criteria. So I guess those are the only 14 states that may survive what Big Brother has planned. But Zero Hedge gets it right here anyway. Is the trend reversal, whether you believe the numbers or not, sufficient to gut the recovery narrative and force states to resume their hated shutdowns and destroy what's left of their economies in coming weeks? And if so, how will the Trump administration react? If history's any guide, folks, they'll talk softly and then do nothing. And will the population even follow any new lockdown measures? And let's just hope, folks, that the population is not dumbed down so much yet that they can't tell the federal government and states to go pound salt when it comes to destroying what's left of their lives. It's past time for Americans to stand up for truths that were once universally called self-evident, but are no longer even allowed to be taught in schools. And we'll be right back. When I think back, all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's start this one off with a bit of serendipity that might tell us more than the mainstream wants us to know. Infant vaccination rates, as a piece from Natural News by Lance D. Johnson, have plummeted during the lockdown. So why, he asks, did infant mortality rates also plummet at the same time to historic lows? Yes, it says, vaccines are praised as the golden standard for saving millions of lives worldwide. That's the promise we're led to believe, anyway, especially as parents are coerced to submit their infant sons and daughters to a cornucopia of state-sanctioned injections. Well, baby visits are designed to introduce up to 26 liability-free vaccinations during the baby's first year of life, in the process of six or more visits to a pediatrician. However, during the COVID-19 lockdowns, well baby visits, as they were called, were canceled, and vaccination rates plummeted as a result. More parents stayed home, nursed their own babies, watched them closely, and kept them away from pediatricians. So maybe there was at least one benefit from the lockdowns. When the National Emergency Order was declared, provider orders for routine pediatric vaccinations dropped significantly. The Vaccines for Children program and the Vaccine Safety Data Link reported a drop-off in vaccination coverage starting in the third week of March, as literally hundreds of thousands of parents stayed home and skipped their well baby visits. And the downtrend was observed from March 23rd through the end of April for all of the non-influenza vaccines, especially those containing measles. I can't show you the charts, but they're actually pretty dramatic, and it begs the question here, why then did infant mortality rates also drop to historic lows as vaccination coverage fell so dramatically, especially if you believe that vaccines are important in allowing infants to live? Why didn't the infant death rate dramatically increase, in other words? In the U.S., infant mortality normally rates about 700 babies per week, and the trend of infant death and sacrifice remains steady between 2014 through 2019. But in 2020, all of this changed, because infant deaths during the period from March through April fell by 30% on average each week, down from 700 a week to only about 500. And as the author notes, for the average death rate to change by 30% in the youngest age group of all is literally unprecedented. And yes, this includes SIDS, or so-called sudden infant death syndrome, which accounts for almost a third of all infant deaths. And while the data here isn't yet definitive, it is certainly more conclusive than that for which an entire nation was locked down and is now being forced to wear idiotic masks as if they actually did something. And as Johnson concludes, if the U.S. can save 200 or more babies on average each week simply by foregoing well baby visits and vaccinations, well then how many more could be saved if pediatric care was reformed entirely, vaccine doses were lessened, and maybe even if vaccine manufacturers were held liable in courts of law? But speaking of liability, governors are now in hot water, if you can imagine that, for killing a whole lot of people in nursing homes, says the piece from Michael Alexander at naturalnews.com. Five state governors are now in hot water after issuing mandates that force nursing homes to take in COVID-19 patients, and that turned out to be a blatant disregard for guidance set earlier by the federal government. According to the Epoch Times, lawmakers from the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis have already sent letters to the governors demanding information, not just on the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths at nursing homes in their states, but also the number of hospital discharges to nursing homes and assisted living facilities. The letter also demanded that the governor supply them with information regarding their executive pandemic orders and directives on nursing homes, as well as other relevant documents and communications between their offices and the state departments of health, SIC, regarding COVID-19. 1984 mitigation, yeah, sure, in long-term care facilities. And they also demanded that governors supply copies of communications between those state health departments and state nursing home administrators. noting that the ongoing pandemic seems to have affected nursing homes disproportionately, almost like somebody planned to kill a whole bunch of people there and inflate the numbers. Said Louisiana Rep. Steve Scalise, "We owe it to those who died and their grieving families to get to the bottom of why these deadly decisions were made by these governors and ensure we stop this from still taking place and prevent tragedies like these from happening again as we continue to battle this deadly virus," unquote. And as you're probably aware, among those governors that some are accusing of having aided and abetted, at a minimum, mass murder, is the dictator of New York, Andrew Cuomo, who issued a decree on May 25th ordering nursing homes and long-term care facilities to accept COVID-19 patients, resulting, said the AP, in over 4,500 COVID patients being shipped off to New York's already beleaguered facilities, where they reportedly caused another 6,432 deaths before the mandate was finally scrapped as the execution order that it turned out to be. And like her socialist comrade in New York, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is also being put to task for her office's directives that spread coronavirus to the elderly in her state. Said Indiana Representative Jackie Walorski, quote, "Just about the worst possible thing to do is knowingly introduce coronavirus to the most vulnerable populations. Yet that's exactly what several states did by mandating nursing homes accept infected patients." Well, I have to say it again, folks. That's only true if it isn't your goal to kill people and inflate the numbers. Oh, and let's not forget, if you want to terrify them and scare them into wearing worse than useless masks, it might be helpful there, too. Walorski went on to say that the misguided policies, her term, enforced by the governors must be scrutinized closely. Quote, "The leaders who put them in place," she said, "have a lot of tough questions to answer." And you know what, folks? It's too bad they won't be asked those questions under oath and while wearing an orange jumpsuit. From there, a couple of stories that ought to be called a word to the wise. First, from the news desk at the Hal Turner radio show, Antifa is planning to desecrate the Gettysburg National Cemetery by burning flags there on July 4th, just before they begin murdering white people and burning down suburbs on the same day. The story said announcements are already appearing on the internet about the desecration of graves where Abraham Lincoln gave the famous Gettysburg Address, but the real eye-opener is from a controlled, unclassified law enforcement bulletin that was issued as law enforcement sensitive for official use only to police and fire departments about Antifa already using fireworks to acclimate suburbia with sounds of explosions so that they can then be used as cover for gunfire when they attack white suburban neighborhoods on that same day. According to the Controlled Unclassified Information, CUI, in a bulletin issued to police and fire departments, Antifa has been taking deliveries of very large shipments of professional-grade fireworks, and they've been sending teams out to various areas throughout the nation to detonate those fireworks over the past 2 weeks to achieve three specific objectives. Number one, the first objective is to test the response of local law enforcement. If fireworks are going off around the clock and residents are filing complaints, will police respond? If so, how long does it take them to respond? And with how many officers? Or do they even respond at all? All of this data is being recorded by the groups, and they'll be very valuable in the way that your host has described as beta tests for a long time now, in order to test the waters for what they've got planned next. Objective number two is to get local residents, i.e. white people in nearby neighborhoods, acclimated to the frequent sounds of explosions that tend to sound like gunfire, but won't be until it's too late. And the third and final objective is to know the response times and manpower of police, and then having acclimated the local population into hearing things that sound like gunfire, is to commit arson attacks with professional fireworks and to set many fires so that local emergency services are immediately overwhelmed, and then they can enter houses to actually fire guns and kill as many people as possible in white suburbia. Says the story, if you do a search with a reliable engine on the web for fireworks complaints, you'll find countless articles posted over just the last week or so, many of them local, while the national media attempts to downplay them as things leading up to the 4th of July. But, says Hal Turner, narratives claiming that massive fireworks activity is due to people celebrating is 100% false. In fact, dangerously so, because as a result of major 4th of July events being shut down and canceled as a result of the COVID-1984 pandemic, an overwhelming surplus of fireworks have now flooded the market. And a number of activist groups, including Antifa, BLM, and the Weather Underground, are exploiting this surplus and purchasing in bulk from suppliers. and this would include highly dangerous professional-grade fireworks. Remember the pallets of bricks being dropped off at locations where rioters plan to do major damage? This looks like a similar strategy. And the bottom line for the story seems to be, don't underestimate the potential for mayhem in the weeks ahead. The goal here, and it makes sense, folks, if you understand the mentality of these people, is to take the nation's most important, specifically national celebration, and turn it into a dark day in hell, which is where they intend to take the nation anyway. Next, Dr. Ron Paul, who almost certainly had the best understanding of economics of anybody in either house for multiple decades. The Fed is getting desperate, he warns. It's a sign, he says, for the Ron Paul Institute, that the Federal Reserve is growing increasingly desperate to jumpstart the economy, that their secondary market credit facility has now begun purchasing individual corporate bonds. The secondary market credit facility was created by Congress, he writes, as part of the so-called coronavirus stimulus bill to purchase as much as $750 billion, or $750 billion, of corporate credit. And until last week, the secondary market credit facility had limited its purchases to exchange-traded funds, which are bundled groups of stocks or bonds. But the bond purchase initiative, like all Fed initiatives, will fail to produce long-term prosperity. These purchases, he writes, distort the economy by increasing the money supply and thus lowering interest rates, which are the price of money. In this case, the Fed's purchase of individual corporate bonds enables select corporations to pursue projects for which they could not otherwise have obtained funding. And that distorts signals sent by the market, as if we still had a free market, folks, making these companies seem like better investments than they actually are, and thus allowing these same companies to attract more private investment, which will cause these companies to experience a, guess what, another Fed-created bubble. And like all Federal Reserve-created bubbles, this corporate bond bubble, too, will eventually burst, causing businesses to collapse, investors to lose their money, unless they're well enough connected to get their government bailout, and workers to lose their jobs. Under the law creating the lending facilities, the Fed doesn't even have to reveal the purchases made by the new facilities. So instead of allowing the Fed to hide this information, Congress, says Dr. Paul, should immediately pass a bill he's been talking about for decades to audit the Fed so people will know whether or not a company is flush with cash because private investors actually determined it was a sound investment or because the Fed chose to, He says invest, I'll say jack up the prices of their bonds. The Fed could and likely will use this bond buying program to advance political goals. Gee, do you think? And the Fed could thus fulfill Socialist Chairman Jerome Powell's stated desire to do something about man-made global warming, a.k.a. climate change, by supporting green energy companies. And the Fed could also use this same power to reward businesses that, well, for example, and I know this is a stretch, folks, support politically correct causes, do things like refuse to sell guns or require their employees and customers to wear masks, or promote unquestioning obedience to the welfare warfare state. Another of the new lending facilities is charged with purchasing the bonds of cash-strapped state and local governments. And here you could insert the words far-left socialist profligate spenders, which could allow the Fed to influence the policies of those governments, which is, of course, nothing new. Says Dr. Paul, it's not wise to reward spendthrift politicians with a federal bailout, whether it's through Congress or the Fed. And with federal lending facilities providing the Federal Reserve the ability to give money directly to obedient governments and politically corrected businesses, the Fed is now just one step away from implementing Helicopter Ben Bernanke's infamous suggestion that if all else fails, yeah, the Fed can just drop money out of a helicopter. Those interventions, he says, though, will not save the economy. Instead, they'll make the inevitable crash all the more painful. The next crash, notes Dr. Paul, can bring about, and your host will suggest that it's intended to bring about, the end of the fiat monetary system. And don't worry, they're planning on having a phoenix rise from its ashes. So the question, says Ron Paul, is not if the current monetary system will end, but when. The only way Congress can avoid the Fed causing another Great Depression is to begin transitioning to a free market monetary system by auditing and then finally ending the Fed. And unfortunately, folks, while he's right, you know darn well that is not going to happen, because all of this is precisely what they've been intending to do for oh so long now. This looks like a good day to spend a few minutes talking about one of Doug Casey's latest missives on the deep state and how it's responsible for, as he puts it correctly, all economic turmoil. And he says he wants to address some aspects of what now is being called the Greater Depression here. The inevitable, he begins, became reality back in 2008. We've had an interlude over the last few years financed by trillions of new currency units. However, the economic clock on the wall is reading the same time as it did in 2007, and the black horsemen of your own worst financial nightmare are about again to crash through the doors and end the party. So, let's talk first about what a depression is. Best definition, a period of time when most people's standard of living drops significantly. And by that definition, the Greater Depression actually started in 2008, although historians may someday say it began in 1971, when real wages started falling. It's also a period of time when distortions and misallocations of capital are liquidated, and when the business cycle, caused exclusively by currency debasement, aka inflation, climaxes. That results in high unemployment, business failures, uncompleted construction, bond defaults, stock market crashes, and the like. But fortunately, for those who benefit from the status quo and members of something called the deep state, the trillions in new currency units delayed that liquidation, but they also ensured it will now happen on a much grander scale. And he notes the deep state is an extremely powerful network that controls nearly everything around you. You won't read about them in the news, of course, because they control the news. Politicians, likewise being controlled, won't talk about it publicly. And while you could say the deep state is hidden, it's really hidden in plain sight. It's the source of nearly every negative thing that's happening right now, though. And to survive the coming rough times, it's essential for you to know what it's all about. Starting with the state itself. And when it comes to economic problems, with the exception of a few natural events like fires, floods, and earthquakes, they're all caused directly or indirectly by the state through its wars, taxes, regulations, and inflation. And yes, he says, I know this is an oversimplification. It's really human nature that's at fault, and the institution of the state is just a mass dramatization of the psychological aberrations and demons that lie within us all. But let's just understand that the very idea of the state, says Doug Casey, itself is poisonous, evil, and intrinsically destructive. But like so many bad ideas, people have come to assume it's part of the cosmic firmament, when really it's just a monstrous scam. And the problem is that although the essence of the state is coercion, people have still been taught to love and respect it. Most people think of the state as having something to do with we the people, electing a Jimmy Stewart-like character to represent them. Now here I have to pause and say most of the millennials and generations X, Y, Z, and so forth won't have any idea what that line meant. They don't have any idea either of what a constitutional republic once was, but somehow do think that having an occasional cortex bent on destroying it must be a good thing. Well, regardless, says Doug Casey, that's a pernicious fiction, because it idealizes, sanitizes, and legitimizes something that's not only intrinsically evil but destructive, because it's based on force. Here he quotes Mao Zedong, who says, all political power flows out of the barrel of a gun. But, says Casey, things have now gone far beyond that, because we're in the deep state, whose tendrils reach from Washington down into every part of civil society, to the point where, like a metastasized cancer, it can no longer be easily eradicated. And the key, he writes, is that the deep state controls the political and economic essence of the United States, which amounts to much more than just observing that there's no real difference between the left and right wings of the same evil bird of prey, which he calls the Demopublican Party. The American deep state, then, is a real but informal structure that has arisen to not just profit from, but control the almighty state. The deep state itself has a life of its own, like government, and it's composed of top echelon employees of a dozen Praetorian agencies, like the FBI, CIA, NSA, ETC, and also top generals, admirals, and other military operatives, long-term congressmen and senators, and directors of important regulatory agencies. But it's much broader than just the government, because it includes the heads of major corporations, all of whom, public-private partners that they are heavily involved in selling the state, selling to the state, and enabling it. It absolutely includes Silicon Valley, and let's not forget their Don't Be Evil motto, which is basically exactly what they intended to do all along. It also, continues Casey, includes all the top people at the Fed and the heads of all the major banks, brokers, and insurers, and the presidents and many professors at top universities, which act as deep state recruiting centers, all the top media figures, of course, and many regulars at things like the Bohemian Grove and Council on Foreign Relations. They, all of them, epitomize the status quo, held together by power, money, and propaganda. He left out sex, but I'm sure that's paid for in there somewhere, too. And as Jeffrey Epstein should have made clear, it's an important mechanism for keeping those who want to get out of line under control. The people he's just described, he says, are the top dogs, but there are hundreds of thousands more who aren't at the nexus but directly depend on them. They have considerable clout and support the deep state because it supports them. That includes many of the wealthy, especially those who got that way thanks to their big brother public-private partner state connections. And it includes more than 1.5 million people with top-secret clearances, top players in organized crime, especially the illegal drug business, little of which would exist without the state, and mid-level types in the police, military, corporations, and NGOs, or non-governmental organizations. These, writes Casey, you might call the running dogs. And beyond that are the scores and scores of millions who depend on things remaining pretty much the way they are, like the 50%+ of Americans who are net recipients of benefits from the almighty state, the 60 million on Social Security, 66 million on Medicaid, 50 million on food stamps, and the many millions on hundreds of other programs, not to mention 23 million government employees and their families. You might call these folks the whipped dogs, because they both love and fear their master. They'll do as they're told, and then roll over on their backs and wet themselves if confronted by a top dog or running dog, even, who feels they're out of line. These three types of dogs, says Casey, make up the vast majority of the U.S. population. Hopefully you aren't among them. I myself, he says, am a lone wolf in this context, and hope you are too. However, dogs are the enemies of wolves and tend to hunt them down. The deep state is destructive, but it's great for the people within it. And like any living organism, its prime directive is to survive by any means necessary. One of the ways it does that, he concludes, is by indoctrinating people in the fiction that it's both good and necessary. However, the truth is, it's a parasite that promotes the ridiculous notion that everyone can live at the expense of society. And at the same time, it exports things that reinforce the deep state, including wars, fiat currency, of course, and lots of destructive policies, all of which is unsustainable, simply because nothing of real value comes out of the swamp. All of which brings me to an interesting question that we'll wrap up with today. Is the communist U.S. deep state at war with or in league with the communist Chinese state? So we'll go to J.R. Nyquist in a piece he calls Chinese Strategy and the Solar Minimum, including what they didn't tell you and what they won't tell you. The solar minimum, of course, is a cyclical weakening of the sun's electromagnetic field and changes in the solar spectrum as well, resulting in more intense bombardment of the oceans by cosmic rays, increasing the formation of low-level clouds that can reflect more of the sun's heat, and the effects on the weather itself could include more frequent spring flooding, shortened growing seasons, especially in northern latitudes, and ultimately a significant decrease in world food production. The Russian and Chinese governments both know about this. The deep state probably does as well, but isn't about to tell people. Nyquist follows that up with a bit of history, but also this question. If global cooling, not anthropogenic global warming, threatens major powers with catastrophic effects, what policies of aggression are likely to emerge as a result? Especially if deep state eugenicists want to kill a bunch of people anyway. Ultimately, the question of who starves and who eats becomes a political one, and as Hitler proved, even a racial one. Today, what is called white privilege might be a term designating those who are about to be expropriated, plundered, or even starved. If Stalin, writes Nyquist, took the food from the Ukrainian kulaks, starving them by the millions to feed the Bolsheviks in the cities, how will the rising leftist movement of today distribute food during a global famine? After all, just listen to the rhetoric of the leftist revolutionaries in the streets. If the leftist redistributionists believe that 3 billion people or so have to starve, who will they single out, deserving of that fate? Touching on this matter, Lawrence Pierce, author of A New Little Ice Age, wrote, "Food will become the ultimate weapon, and the best way to defeat your enemies without being the bad guy is just to find a way to not ship food to them." meaning that the strategic significance of the United States as a food producer in an overpopulated world cannot be underrated from the perspective of a country like Communist China, which contains 1.4 billion people unable to feed themselves from their own land. And given all the traitors we've seen in the United States over the last few decades, as well as the activation of the Communist Fifth Column on American soil, not to mention the use of Chinese economic and social blackmail on America's elite, the country is now a tempting target on the eve of the solar minimum. We'd better, he concludes, understand not only the enemy's strategy, but the rationale behind the timing, too. And that, of course, applies literally all over the nation today.